He's better at it than I am.
Thank you, Stephanie, for allowing me to speak. So, some brief history of me. I'm a doctor of clinical psychology. I have a private practice I maintain in South Denver. I'm also a lecturer at the University of Colorado at Denver and adjunct faculty at Argus University. And a main component of my treatment for various sundry afflictions that come about in the human mind periodically is mindfulness. Mindfulness meditation and informal ways of cultivating mindfulness. So, we'll begin. So this talk is designed to be, it's very, very short, so it's difficult to communicate sophisticated concepts in a short period of time, so bear with me. So we'll begin. So the idea is to cover modern mind science, psychotherapy, and the creation of meaning in people's lives, and how those two things might come to bear in the creation of meaning in people's lives. Meaning being like, why do most people come to psychotherapy? Why would they seek out a psychologist? Most of the time, it's to create meaning. They're experiencing some kind of suffering, some kind of trauma going on in their lives. And they're confused and maybe overwhelmed. And they need to find a context for it. They need to create meaning for it. So how can modern mind science and psychotherapy and mindfulness perhaps provide a vehicle for the creation of meaning? So we'll begin going back in history to William James, about 1892. He was the original American psychologist. And he was into introspection in a very big way. And one of my favorite quotes from James, he said, was, "For the moment, what we attend to becomes reality. In essence, what you pay attention to becomes very real for you. Attention, concentration on a psychological level is just energy. So whatever you're paying energy to becomes reinforced, becomes real, becomes your reality." So that was a revolutionary statement that James made and went relatively unnoticed by and large for the last 100 years or so. And it's only been recently, say in the last 15 years, we've decided to begin testing that statement. We've decided to begin trying to understand. We got out of behavioralism in the medical model and this trying to understand the mind through human behavior, which is very limited. And we started trying to understand the components of the mind. What is consciousness? What is a thought? What is an emotion? And it's rather difficult to do. So we thought we would begin with some simple experiments. Say, take a handful of very advanced Buddhist meditators and run MRIs and fMRIs on them and determine the construction of their brain and their neurology and compare that to a control group, people who don't meditate. So just average people selected at random. Now these meditators had upwards of 60,000 hours of meditative experience in their lifetimes. And compared to a control group, they have massively different brains. Massively different in the sense that the areas that are responsible or at least associated with, perhaps not responsible, but associated with compassion, kindness, patience, perseverance, these areas were pronounced far beyond the control group. Also, the cerebral cortex was more developed than the control group. That was very interesting. And so, in essence, this is verification that what James was saying was true. So empirical data, because we in the West fall back on empirical data quite a bit. We love science and the scientific method. And even though it has trouble studying first-person subjective phenomena, you know, science is really about studying third-person phenomena. Even though science has difficulty studying first-person subjective phenomena, we can compare neurologies. And we have determined that what James was saying was true. So those have been studies ongoing in various ways at MIT and Harvard, Stanford, for the past 15 years. Recently, there's been a project done by one of my teachers named Alan Wallace called the Shamatha Project. Shamatha is the Sanskrit term for mindfulness. So he's a preeminent Buddhist scholar and a mind scientist. And he wrote a grant and decided to do research in essence, looking at what happens to people in the process of gaining meditative competency. So he brought all these people together, actually in the Rocky Mountains, just last year, did two different three-month sessions, and instructed them in mindfulness meditation, and had a team of scientists there to give them routine MRIs and take blood samples and saliva samples and the rest of it, and find out what, if anything, would change over the course of them becoming more accomplished meditators. And compared that to a control group, of course. Now, preliminarily speaking, he's found tremendous results between those two, biochemically, neurologically, and relative to a self-report on the quality of people's minds. He's found a tremendous distinction between the two groups. So again, this is verification of what James was talking about. Also, over the past 15 years, mindfulness has been associated with a host of positive mental qualities and characteristics. It's also been associated with a decrease in the levels in people. So people who practice mindfulness meditation have a decrease in psychological trauma, drug and alcohol addiction. They have less post-operative and chronic physical pain. People suffering from physical pain, even chronic. Phobic reactivity, meaning irrational fears that are intensive, you know, germophobes and fear of heights and things like that. Insomnia, chronic insomnia, and also just generalized mental stress and anxiety, which, as we're finding out now, really work to produce a lot of physical illness, the level of stress and anxiety we carry around with us on a day-to-day level. Mindfulness has also been empirically correlated with increases in positive mental phenomena, like memory capacity, mental awareness, mental clarity and insight, feelings of happiness and well-being, virtuous emotionality, so generosity, compassion, perseverance, humility, things like that, been associated with increases in that. Mindfulness has also been associated with increases in overall physical health. So those who meditate will become healthier. So it's not uncommon in my own psychological practice to see people come in with irritable bowel syndrome, chronic insomnia, hypertension, things like that. And in practicing mindfulness meditation for 3 or 6 months, those conditions often just disappear completely. So in my own practice of it, as a psychologist, I've seen tremendous positive effect in injecting mindfulness meditation as a treatment methodology, into drug and alcohol addiction, bipolar disorders, major depressions, pathological griefs, personality disorders of various kinds, habitually violent personalities. I did my fourth year in postdoc residencies with men convicted of sex offenses and various parolees for robbery and some for murder and things like that. So when these men would meditate, they would improve. The quality of their minds would improve. Their levels of compassion would improve. Also worked with a lot of gangbangers who I introduced to mindfulness meditation. Saw positive results there. Also sexual paraphilias and a host of other difficulties that we're starting to discover have some root in the mind. And so if you can begin to explore the nature of the mind and begin to learn to work with the mental phenomena you find there, it will be beneficial. It's positive. So, what is mindfulness, and why is it so useful? Mindfulness goes, it's an ancient practice, going back to before the historical Buddha, which was 500 BC, going back into Hinduism, probably to about 3000 BC, when it was first begun to develop and was utilized as a very routine cognitive technology for exploring mental phenomena. So what are mental phenomena? In Buddhist psychology, as opposed to Aristotelian psychology, Western psychology, there are actually 6 senses. The 6th being that of the mind is considered to be a sense. So to understand what mental phenomena would be, you can imagine if you were placed in a sensory deprivation tank, so that you had no sight and no sound and no taste and no touch and no smell, and you were suspended there in a viscous body temperature liquid, for a period of time, all of your physical senses would fade away. And what would be left to you then? Do you think? Any guesses? Your what?
Your mental sense.
Yeah, thoughts, emotions, judgments, opinions, perceptions, images, fantasies, memories. Right? All of these things are mental phenomena, and they belong in the domain of the mind. And mindfulness seeks, in essence, mindfulness is also called calm abiding, or single point of focus. Mindfulness seeks to create awareness of and space between you and all the things that you think and feel. So quite normally, we walk around identified with everything that we think and feel, so that we can see it in our language even. We say, I am angry. So I am this thing, right? I am this feeling. So this is identification, yes? All right, so normally we walk around like that, identified with everything that we think and feel and believe and judge and have opinions about, right? And mindfulness is the idea that we don't have to be identified with that. We don't have to be identified with our mental phenomena. Mental phenomena come and go. They arise and fall away quite of their own accord. So that if you just were silent for a while and leaned back in a chair and tried to think about nothing, you would find that that might be quite impossible to do. That thoughts would come up. Despite what your intention was, emotions would arise. Memories, fantasies, right? Usually the emotion of boredom would arise, right? So, and your habit would be to grasp onto these things and identify with them. I am this thing, right? Okay, so mindfulness is this idea that that is not necessary to do. Mindfulness is the idea that that is a child's habit. It is something that we were supposed to have grown out of. But given our culture and the priorities of our current culture, we never learned. No one ever taught us about how to work with mind. What is a thought? What is an emotion? Currently, we have no working definition for consciousness. We have no idea what consciousness is. None at all. And you would think for a bunch of psychologists and people teaching at Harvard and MIT that you would have a working definition of consciousness. We don't. So you can imagine where physics would be if they had no working definition of gravity. Right? And everyone had a different opinion about what gravity might be. Okay, so we have no working definition for these things, really. Nor do we understand where thoughts come from, where emotions come from. But we do know that thoughts can create emotions. Emotions can create thoughts. You can have a feeling about an opinion that you have. You can have a thought about a feeling that you have. A judgment about a feeling. You can have a feeling about a judgment, right? So these things mix together, and they create what we think of as being our mind. Now, again, normally we walk around identified with our mind, but mindfulness is this idea that that's not necessary. It is possible to create space between you and everything that you think and feel. So normally if you're walking around just identified with everything you think and feel, you become one with it. Mindfulness is this idea that there can be some space existing. So, okay, so what happens normally, we walk around completely identified. Will you keep track of time for me too? Because I'm not sure. Normally we walk around completely identified with everything that we think and feel. This makes us very confused. It makes our mind fragmented. It makes us stressed out and anxious. We have constantly racing minds, right? Sometimes we try and go to sleep and we can't shut our heads off. We might be carrying stress around in our bodies because our minds are so fragmented and anxious, and continually identifying with every mental phenomena that arises there, no matter what triggers it, right? No matter what the context is. Okay, so then you might get hit with some suffering. Now, according to existential psychology, there are 7 universal sufferings that happen to all human beings. Now, we can go over these and spend a couple of minutes going over these. And the point is not to become depressed and discouraged. This is not the idea. Right? The point is to become realistic about your mind and about the experience of life, perhaps about the experience of thinking and feeling. Okay, so to the idea would be to learn to transform suffering into clarity and awareness and insight. Because the sufferings are inescapable. If you're a human being and you're born in a human body, you will suffer in very predictable ways, and there is no way out. Therefore, if there's no way out, you might as well use it to your benefit. The universal sufferings are birth. Everyone is born, and we're born in a state of helplessness. And that's very disconcerting, by and large. We are so helpless that, in fact, if we were left to our own devices as infants for even a small period of time, we would die. Okay? Now, births also create disorientation and confusion in families, oftentimes. So the birth of a new child into a marriage that has, prior to that, been childless can be disorienting. The birth of a child into an existing family and the child has difficulties, physical problems, can create a lot of stress and trauma and difficulty. Also, aging. We're uncomfortable with aging. We don't like getting older. But the fact is, from the moment that sperm and ovum meet in the womb, you are, in fact, getting older. And there is no stopping that process. So that we seem to be uncomfortable with it on some very fundamental levels. So if you ask a 3 or 4 year old kid how old they are, they'll usually say, I'm 4 and a half. I'm 4 and 3 quarters, right? I'll be 7 next month, kind of thing, right? There's this sense of I'm not old enough. I'm too young. I'm uncomfortable, right? You get the same thing with teenagers, of course. I'll be 16 in a week, right? It's not that I'm 15. It's that I'll be 16 in a month or whatever, right? And we hit our 20s and 30s, and most of us are relatively comfortable with that. But we hit 40, 50, we start becoming intensely uncomfortable with it. Only now, the uncomfortability, the discomfort is, I'm too old. I need to be younger. It's this present, ever-present energy that exists in our minds. So we'll start rounding our age down, right? We'll start forgetting birthdays. So the market for Botox and plastic surgery and these kinds of interventions on a medical level is testament to this. So these markets are exploding. We're very uncomfortable. Also, sickness. So you will become sick. You have been sick before, and guess what? You'll be sick again. It's just a matter of time. And we suffer from everything from colds and flus and little illnesses all the way up to AIDS and cancer and hepatitis and bone marrow problems and all kinds of stuff. And that's inescapable. There's really no way out of it. Even if you keep yourself in tip-top physical condition, and you exercise and eat whatever you think you should eat and go to a nutritionist and you spend a lot of time and money keeping yourself really healthy, the fact is you will fall ill. And there's really no way out of that. And the next is death. The fact that we will meet our own mortality at some point. Now this at some point, so death is certain. Absolutely certain. There's no escaping it. Life, however, is completely uncertain. In that it can strike at any moment. Right. Most of the time we walk around with fantasies in the back of our minds that we're going to grow quite old and we'll die quite peacefully in our sleep, surrounded by our loved ones and so forth. If you look at the statistics from the World Health Organization on death, you'll see that's a fairy tale. That people die when they're children. People die as teenagers. They die as young adults, middle age, so on and so forth. So there is no escaping it. And in fact, your life is quite impermanent. So the idea would be, one idea to create meaning, would be to reflect on these things. If this were your last day on earth, how would you use it? Right? Going back to the issue of time, right? The thing that we heard. How do you use your time? Given that you have perhaps a precious opportunity here, given that you weren't born in Africa, you weren't born in South America, you weren't born into extreme poverty, you weren't born into a war-torn country, it's full of strife. You have leisure and fortune at your disposal. How are you using it? What meaning are you creating? Okay, and the last couple, which we won't go over at any length, is unfortunate circumstances beyond your control. This happens to all of us. Separation from people, places, and things that we want or desire. And the fact that everything in our lives is impermanent, always changing. So fortunes come and go, marriages can come and go, like that. Right? Everything's shifting and changing all the time. So, because our minds are so fragmented and confused, and so automatically identified with everything that we think and feel, we have this low level of confusion, disorientation, and anxiety constantly present in our minds all the time. We get into habits of becoming emotionally reactive to certain triggers. We have habits around fear and anger and stress, right? So all these things are currently at play. Then a suffering will hit us, right? Somebody dies. Hits you like a Mack truck. Or you go to the doctor's office and he tells you you've got a serious illness. Then it gets even worse. Then we become overwhelmed. We can become completely reactive. We can begin to melt down. Okay, so this is where usually people start to seek out introspection, psychotherapy in particular. Something's happened to them, and it's jarred their existence to the point where they've become overwhelmed. And they realize on some level that they need some orientation. They need some input to help make sense of the situation. Okay, now, normally when we become overwhelmed, we don't seek to stay with the sense of overwhelm. We don't seek to stay with the fear. We don't seek to stay with, the anger, the irritation, the sense of unfairness about it, right? Instead, we try to exit these emotions. So we become overwhelmed and disoriented by the suffering that's hit us, and then we'll seek to exit our own mental experience. Now, there are three ways that people typically seek to exit their own mental experience of life. The first is to numb out. So we can use drugs and alcohol for that. We can use food. We can use sex. We can use gambling. We can use any number of things, right? Over shopping, overspending, right? Could be anything. The next is to become angry and aggressive. So we get pissed off. Oh, sorry. Stephanie's on me about my language. So we get angry, right? And anger, to sustain itself, needs an object of blame. For anger to be resonant in your mind for any length of time, you need to project that onto somebody in the form of blame. So that if anger does not have an object of blame, it cannot last. So we seek out an object of blame, right? We project our anger onto it. And once that's occurred, then it's very easy to become aggressive, hostile towards other people. And the third major exit door is materialism, especially in our culture. We love to shop. Retail therapy, the cliche, right? There's more truth to that than whoever made that up might know. That it is an escape for us. It is a way that we try to cope with the suffering that we experience. Midlife crises are another materialistic form of this. So it's not uncommon for me to see men in their early 40s who are having affairs, who have a wife and children, and they realize they're devastating their entire existence. But they can't seem to stop. It's this existential anxiety. Half my life is over and I don't know if I've spent it well. And this keeps them up at night and drives them into afflictive behaviors. Right? Okay, so what if we could learn to stop? What if we could learn to bear witness to the ways that we exit our own experience? What if we could learn to just be present and stay with a thought, or an emotion, or a judgment, or an opinion, or a perception? What if we could do that? Now, mindfulness is this idea that that is possible to do. And it's eminently more healthy than exiting, because it's counterintuitive. Like, if your body is ill, you'll go to a medical doctor, and he'll rip out whatever is ill, right, inside of you. When you talk about human psychology, this is just not the case. It doesn't work like that. So that the more you exit, the more you resist whatever afflictive energy is in your mind, the stronger it becomes, the more pronounced it becomes. So it is counterintuitive, but it is very necessary to understand that. So that if you have fear and panic and overwhelm and confusion and anxiety, right, the more you resist it, the more you numb out with booze, the more you buy stuff you don't need, the more angry you become and project blame onto the world, the more you are reinforcing and strengthening that emotion that you seek to escape. That's the way it works. And so, mindfulness is the idea that we can stay, we can learn to stay with our own mental experience. we can learn to create that space again between us and everything that we think and feel. And it first requires that you understand that you are currently identified with everything that you think and feel, and walking around as if you have some kind of grasp on absolute reality. And in fact, you do not. Not even close. Your thoughts and feelings are just thoughts and feelings. They don't contain any inherent reality whatsoever. So, first understanding this, and then cultivating the desire to observe, to get a little space between you and everything that you think and feel. Okay, so at that point you will have created some level of mental freedom. You will have begun to calm down. You will have begun to slow down a little bit. You will begin to see patterns in the things that you think and feel. You will begin to see patterns in the ways that you might be triggered by outside people, places, and things, and how that comes up in your mind, right? What thoughts and emotions meet that trigger, and how you spin off on your own thoughts and emotions. You become very reactive to certain things outside of you. You'll begin to watch yourself becoming very reactive. You'll begin to watch yourself while you're panicked. Watch yourself while you're terrified. Watch yourself while you're stressed. You'll catch yourself in the act of being terrified. You'll catch yourself in the act of exiting, right? You'll start to notice all of these things about yourself. And that noticing creates awareness. It creates awareness about your own mind and the ways in which you interact with your context around you, your environment around you. This awareness is like a breath of fresh air in and of itself. It will calm things out and relax things to some extent, thereby providing more motivation for you to continue to cultivate mindfulness. So, some brief ways in which mindfulness can be cultivated. If I asked you all to introspect, how much time do I have, Stephanie?
Okay, 10 more.
Okay. If I asked you all to introspect very quickly, you might not know how to do that, but it's quite simple. Just if you can, take the next 3 seconds and notice what you're thinking and notice what you're feeling. You've just introspected. It's really that easy, right? So that's introspection. Mindfulness takes it to the next level, okay? So that you could do something crazy like every time you see the color red, you introspect. You just take 2 or 3 seconds out. Every time you're at a stoplight, every time you're at a stop sign, every time you're watching TV and the color red arises in your visual spectrum, you take 2 seconds out, 3 seconds out, and ask yourself, what am I thinking right now? And what am I feeling? Now, if you did this 50 times, 150 times, it would produce a little effect. If you did it 10,000 times, you would begin to notice. You would begin to notice patterns. You would catch yourself in the act periodically of becoming overwhelmed. Catch yourself in the act of fear, really cultivating a lot of fear. You catch yourself in the act of being happy. You catch yourself in the act of being joyous. Catch yourself in the act of being bored. Right? You would begin to notice your mind and where your mind is. You would also begin to notice that you, if you're mindful by definition, you are not identified with your thoughts and emotions. And normally if we walk around thinking, I am what I think and feel, this would undo the very foundation of that supposition. You are not what you think and feel. There is another level called consciousness. So, if you are not what you think and feel, then what are you? So you start asking kind of scary questions. Questions that can be quite profound. Questions that can start having spiritual implications, perhaps. Right? Okay, so that's the color red. So if you just chose to do that as an experiment for the next 3 months, you just walked around and every time you saw the color red, you checked in with yourself. What am I thinking? What am I feeling? You would begin to become mindful. So that if you did that 50,000 times, you would just kind of be walking around in a state of mindfulness after a while. Does that make sense to everyone? Yeah. Okay. So another method, this is one I use. I use all of these, actually, of emotions, mindfulness about emotions. Next time you're in the grocery store or walking down the street and you see somebody walking towards you, pay attention to what you think and feel as you see that person. You'll notice weird things. You'll notice slight attractions, slight repulsions to people. You'll notice perhaps apathetic reactions. You really have no reaction at all to that person. Maybe you have a big reaction, big negative reaction for some reason to this person, a total stranger walking towards you, right? Maybe you have a whole bunch of stories about this person that just kind of like, they just click in. And you're telling yourself stories about this guy or this woman, right? And they're negative stories. And you don't even know this person. Maybe you'll see the same thing on the other end of the spectrum, telling yourself real positive stories about this person. And again, you don't even know them. So it's interesting to see how reactive, how much you really are on autopilot as you walk around through your life. This will bring you in direct contact with that. And if you have courage, psychological and intellectual courage, it might be something to try. It'll brush you right up against your autopilot. And then you'll have a choice to make. Do you want to continue on autopilot? Or do you want to cultivate mindfulness? Because from the position of mindfulness, when you cease to be identified with everything you think and feel, now you can become the creator of your reality. If James was correct, and everything that we pay attention to, everything that we concentrate on becomes real, it becomes invested with reality. If that's true, then mindfulness will allow you to begin to work with your thoughts and emotions. They will allow you eventually to be able to transform greed into generosity, to be able to transform lust into, what is the opposite of lust? lust into chastity, pride into humility, right? Gluttony into abstinence. It will allow you to do it. But not until you develop a tremendous amount of awareness, right? Because you can't fix a problem until you know what the problem is. It's not possible to do, right? You must diagnose and you must evaluate the problem. Then you must apply the appropriate antidote. This is how changes occur psychologically. Okay, and if anyone's interested, I did a mindfulness seminar recently. And it can be accessed on my website, which is amidenver.com, amidenver.com. And I'm also going to post this talk on the website. It'll be on my homepage as the first link on the very top. So any of you would like to review the material, you're free to do that as well. And we have questions and answers.
We have time for questions and answers.
Can dreams trigger fear?
In the dream, you mean?
They say it's a bad dream.
Uh-huh.
Can that trigger fear in a person's life?
What do you think?
I think it can.
Yeah, I think you're right. Don't need a PhD for that, right? So yeah, if you have a horribly scary dream and you remember it during the day, right, something in your day triggers it and it comes back, right, the sense of fear will come back.
Can it have the opposite effect? The fear triggers nightmares.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I don't know of any research that's empirically validated that. But in my experience as a human being and also as a psychologist, yeah, that's true. The more you cultivate fear, the more you'll cultivate the ramifications of fear, part of which are night terrors, nightmares, things like that.
Who was the original test group? Were they already compassionate people?
Oh, in the study I mentioned?
The study, was it a group of nuns? Was it a group of...
It was a group of yogis, Buddhist yogis, that we pulled out of their caves.
So they had a propensity for compassion.
Oh, yes, very much.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes any difference. It's just...
Oh, no, I think it does.
If you're going to show a compassionate brain and there's propensity for compassion, then...
Oh, yeah. Not only propensity, again, they had spent 60,000 hours at a minimum.
Yeah.
Like do the math on that. 60,000 hours in meditation.
How
cultivating
people,
compassion.
How many people in here have meditated before?
Other than moments, no. That brings up a question, if I may.
Huh.
About meditation. How does one... I'll use myself an example. I've attempted to meditate... And I know people who claim they meditate on a regular basis, and they have with great results.
Mm-hmm.
But I seem to struggle with the process. How does one get into it? How do you teach someone to meditate relatively, you know, the process relatively quickly?
I don't know that there is a relatively quickly about it. Mm-hmm. The informal methods that I just talked about are one way that you can begin to kind of like plow the ground a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The formal techniques... are difficult to engage with, primarily because our minds are so fragmented and ill-disciplined. So the normal analogy given when you're trying to cultivate mindfulness, say, if you just try and bring your attention, your concentration to the sensations of respiration in your abdomen and leave it there so that you can remain there in a concentrated fashion and undistracted. Okay. The normal process for someone who's never tried that before is to be constantly distracted. Right? So you'll bring your awareness to whatever the object of meditation is, say, the feeling of respiration, and you'll be pulled out all the time by some ambient noise around you in the environment, by a thought, by an emotion, so on and so forth. Okay, so the usual analogy is training a puppy. So you got to housebreak a puppy. So how do we do that? Well, we lay out some newspaper, you grab the puppy, right, and you put him on the newspaper, and you keep him there until he urinates, right? That's what you do. Then he'll wander off, right? And then you make sure you grab him again 3 or 4 hours later, and you put him back on the paper. Keep him there until he urinates, right? And he'll try to wander off periodically. Even while he's on the paper, he'll wander off. You got to pick him up and put him back, right? Pick him up again, put him back, right? So it's the same process. Then eventually he gets it. He starts to understand, oh, I go on the paper. I get it, right? Then you move the paper outside. So now he associates the paper with outside, so now he'll go outside to do it, and then eventually you eliminate the paper. And now he's trained. It's a similar process. So every time you have attention here, every time you have concentration on the object of meditation, you will be distracted, and it's this process of noticing that you've become distracted. Mindfully, noticing that you've become distracted. So you don't get reactive, you don't get frustrated, you don't bear down on yourself. Nor do you just throw in the towel and say, I can't do this, right? You have patience. You cultivate patience and perseverance. And you bring your mind back. It'll go off again. You bring your mind back. Again, it will leave. You bring it back. Over and over and over again. Thousands and thousands of times. Until eventually, your mind stays. It learns to stay where you tell it to stay. It learns to do what you tell it to do. So if you tell it, I want to be uninterrupted for 30 seconds, your mind will respond to that. No thoughts and emotions will enter. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a process of training. It's a skill. Mindfulness is a mental skill. And like any other skill, it takes appropriate instruction and practice. Yeah. That it?
Well, we appreciate you being a speaker here today. And since we're a small club, we always have our fun gift for you. The small club is a token.
Gift.
It's a token of our appreciation. And on the back of it, it has the four-way test.